If I should choose any artwork hanging in Denmark, this would be the work. It's my absolute favorite work. And that is Matisse's portrait of his Madame Matisse green line. When he made that back in 1905, it changed the whole way of making portraits. And I'm sure people at that time said, you can't paint like that. It not only changed art history, it's also as a painting, a beautiful painting you never get tired of looking at. It's completely abstract painting. It's an abstract painting more than it's a portrait. It's fantastic. I can't tell you why. It's just so beautiful. What I really like in that painting is the colors. It hits my guts, and I'm just saying, wow. And I still say it each time I see it. I got my injection of art for the day if I see that painting.
My name is Tina Jung Christensen, and I'm the host of Danish Originals, a podcast series created in partnership with the National Gallery of Denmark and the American Friends of the National Gallery of Denmark. Our goal is to celebrate Danish creatives who've made a significant mark in the US. Today, our guest is Jens Fagerskov, a Danish gallery owner. Welcome, Jens.
Thank you.
Actually, maybe we should say the other way around, that you welcome us because we're in your house, actually.
That's true. Welcome to Humlebæk.
Thank you so much. We are in the northern part of Copenhagen, in your private house. Usually we record from Los Angeles. Tell us where in the world we are and about the place that you call home.
We are just about down the coast, maybe 1 kilometer from Louisiana, which I think most Americans who are interested in art knows. It's our very famous museum, which were founded by Knut W. Jensen. Another pearl, like SMK.
And you are a gallery owner. You opened a gallery back in 1986 in Copenhagen called Galleri Fagerskov. What motivated you to open the gallery?
What really motivated me was that I met a lot of young artists at a job I had as a student at Kunstbibliotheket, and it was just a lovely experience for me. I had no experience running a gallery. I had no experience in art history. I had studied business economics at the Copenhagen Business School. I can't say it was something I had dreamt of my whole life. It just happened.
You were more dreaming about becoming a CEO?
Yes. I don't know what it's called in English. Maybe you can translate it for me. I got a master in regnskabsvæsen og økonomistyring, med hovedfag i koncernstyring. So I really thought that I should one day be the head of one of our big Danish companies.
Planning, economic planning?
Something like that.
Something like this. And in the 80s, you went to New York. It was a bit of a culture shock for you.
This was in the summer of 1984. I had no idea about the art scene in New York, and I was actually just on vacation to see this city. Of course, I knew that it should be the most amazing city in the world. I met up with John Hendricks. I later learned that he was Yoko Ono's manager when it comes to curating her art exhibitions. And he took me out in New York, and that was a very interesting experience.
Talk about that evening.
It was Stelag from Australia, and he had this performance that night. A lot of the buildings in the Lower East Side at that time was abandoned. He was coming out a window on a wire, hooks in his skin over the street. The performance could not be announced before because it was illegal, because he was naked. So he came out and was hanging in the middle of the street in, against this beautiful sky. And there was people from the art world who were there because it was gone from mouth to mouth that he would do this performance. And then, of course, other people came as well who were in the area. And then also the police came. And I remember there was one who shouted, "Shoot him down."
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I think it was for fun. His assistants pulled him in and he came down. And my friend John said to me, "I'm afraid they're going to take him to the station, keep him overnight, put him in front of a judge. And that will not be nice." But when Stella came down in a rope, the policeman told him that he had violated the law, being naked in public, and he got a fee of $50.
50? Okay. That's doable.
That's doable. So it could have been different. Maybe 5 years ago, I was just searching about this performance, and I found a photograph where I see myself standing among other people on the other side of the street of the house where he came out. And I could see my very long hair in 1984. It was actually beautiful, but it was also very disturbing. And I was really asking myself, what is art? Is this art? And I learned from John, who became a very good friend, that art is when your borders challenged. And I must say they were that evening, which was one of my first evenings in New York.
And how do you think that something like that shapes you and as a gallery owner and when you're looking for art that you want to represent?
I think you always have to be open to what you experience when you come out. And if there's something you don't understand, then maybe you should get a closer look instead of saying, "Oh, I don't understand this," and walk away. That's probably what I learned from that experience.
And you grew up on the island of Fyn in the middle of Denmark, where I also grew up. Where exactly did you grow up, and was it a family of artists? How did you get inspired?
I grew up in the suburb to Odense and Nesby, okay, and later Tarporp. Mm-hmm. My parents had grocery stores, so I learned to clean floors and put things up in the grocery store since I was five. That was normal, and actually I liked it. And my whole youth, my brother and me and my sister, we always worked until we were 18 and went further on in life, yeah.
So no artists in the family?
No artists in the family. My parents were interested in ceramics, mm-hmm, and they took me around to studios in Fyn where there were artists working in that media. And I loved that, actually.
What was it like initially being part of the art world in Copenhagen?
At the time when we opened the gallery, there was very few galleries. There was Asbæk and there was Birk and a few others, where today there's a lot. So it was very different. There was also much fewer artists than there is today. So it was not so difficult to figure out who are the great artists and who are the less good artists. And then, of course, you try to work with the ones you feel are the great artists of our time.
And what was it about that world that made you change your whole plan about what you wanted to do in life?
Probably the artist, that you can work with people who think so different than all us who is not artists. This creative way they work and don't take anything as that we can't question things. There's a lot of things we don't question in our daily life, but they do, and they do it all the time. Then we see their works and we start to think And maybe 20 years later, it's not disturbing what they were doing.
Did you ever dream about becoming an artist?
No.
No? Not at all?
Nope. And I don't dream of my children being artists, because I think it's a very lonely way of living. You know, you are alone with your work and you can't do it with anyone else. It's you and it's only you. And you have to go through whatever you have to go through. I think being a family member to an artist can be challenging. So I don't hope my children will be artists. I think it's a very, very hard way to go.
Some people do create communities around it, like Superflex, for instance.
Yes, that's right. But it's very rare, very rare. I think the best example I have on that is Jan Kruger, who was a Holocaust survivor. As a child, he was adopted by a Swiss family and came to Switzerland and became an artist and good friend with Giacometti. It didn't work so well out for him, and Giacometti told him one day, you know, to be an artist, it's such a lonely way. What you need to talk to people and be with people. So he became one of the best art dealers and galleries that existed in Switzerland. So there's a big difference between being an artist and not being an artist, for sure. And the whole way your social life is. I'm sure on that.
Mm-hmm. Is the for-profit art world in Denmark a competitive one?
Yes, of course it's competitive. It's competitive in two ways. Of course, there's about having the clients. You all want to have the ones who spend the most money and who are considered good collectors. So there's competition on that side, and then there's definitely a competition about who work with what artist, and there's a strong competition there, of course.
How does one put a financial value on a piece of art?
Okay, yes, because there's many values of art. Artists, they control their production, so they can basically put their price themselves, and they can decide to put it high. Then they will sell very few, and they can decide to put them low, and then they might sell more. It's a very different decision to take, because if you sell a lot and you come out to many people, then maybe you create a bigger demand, actually. So if you want to get a big demand and be known, that you're not too expensive to begin with, and then you can slowly raise your price. But it's very dangerous to raise the price too high, because if you don't sell, that's a negative success also. In the art world, the biggest success rate you have is if your paintings are selling for a lot of money at auction. It doesn't mean that it's the best art. But in the market, it means a lot. For the artist, it's important to have a price where the demand is still strong, and the best is if the demand is higher than the supply, because that shows a success, you know. And then people might need to go and buy it at auction because they can't get it at the exhibition because it's sold out. And that can keep the auction prices up. So it's a very interesting market.
And since you came from Copenhagen Business School, did you have a different take on all that?
Setting the prices always interests me and still does. I'm very interested in how are prices made in the art world, and both in the primary market, which is a monopoly, and then in the secondary market, which is free when it comes to auction. It should be free. There might be people who try to manipulate it, just as you have in the stock market, where it's illegal. In the art market so far, it had not been illegal. But, you know, if you have a big holding of an artist and work come to the market, it might be in your interest to keep a high price. For instance, the Mughrabi family, who are the biggest owners of Andy Warhol's in the world, have for sure, I will not call it manipulated here, but they have for sure bought a lot of paintings at auction, you know, to keep up the value of their holdings.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Warhol, I believe you almost met with him.
Yes, that's right.
Talk about that.
Yeah, that hurts.
Sorry.
It was in the summer of 1986. I was fly fishing up in Norway. It's a hobby I really enjoy, where you forget everything.
But get inspired.
Get inspired, exactly. And I got an idea, which I would love to present for Andy Warhol. I knew that Andy Warhol was very open for ideas. You know the story about Jørgen Leth and the Whopper. And there was another Dane who got an idea that Andy Warhol should make this series of Hans Christian Andersen, which also was done. So I worked on this idea for about half a year, and then I called Andy Warhol's manager, Fred Hughes. And to my surprise, it was very easy to get an appointment with Andy Warhol. So I got in the book some date in early spring 1987. And then I had to leave a Monday, and I would see him on a Wednesday. And on the Sunday, I was visiting my parents-in-law, and my brother-in-law was also there working outside. And at lunchtime, he came in and he said, "Who was it you were going to meet in New York?" "Andy Warhol." "Oh, he just died." He was one who always joked, so I didn't really take notice of it. And then the same evening, I opened for the news, Danish TV news. We only had one channel at that time, so it was very simple, you know, and very few programs still. And the first news which came out was that Andy Warhol died. I remember I went straight to the bar. I took out a bottle of Dimple whiskey, I remember it was, and I think I finished the bottle.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. You were very disappointed.
Yes, because this had been in the head for more than half a year, and you know, yeah, I was very disappointed.
Incredibly disappointing.
Yeah, but I have had the luck to meet a lot of other artists who, thank God, didn't die just before I had to meet them.
Maybe brag about them. Who are they, the people that, you know, you feel honored to have met?
Anselm Kiefer, Bill Viola, Shirin Neshat, Ai Weiwei. And I have made exhibitions with all of them, you know. So that's how you get to know them. And Doug Aitken.
Are they as special as people as they are as artists?
Everyone of the artists are very special. They're not that I can say one artist is like another one, because they are very special. Absolutely.
You have made quite an international career of yourself. You opened a gallery in New York. You've opened one in Beijing, of all places. Talk about those experiences, going out in the world and opening galleries, especially in China, must be challenging.
Yeah, China was very challenging, but also very gifting in the way it's like my meeting back in 1986 with this performance in Lower East Side. China opened my way of thinking to another level in terms of art.
Can you explain how?
Yes, they are, I don't know, 1.5 billion or something like that. They are a lot of Chinese. And we are only 5.5 or whatever here. We were five when I was born. And I think being a small country, even though we are thinking and we are doing a lot of good stuff out in the world, we still haven't... It might sound wrong, but a smaller way of thinking. What I saw out there, the way they were planning their museums, when they were building museums, and I met a lot of these people who were actually in the process of building museums. It was with big rooms, with space for big art installations and things like that, which I have never had the space for, of course, in the gallery. And the museums we have here in Denmark don't have this kind of spaces. So that really meant a lot to me. And I think if I hadn't been in China, I don't think we had had Copenhagen Contemporary here in Denmark, because it comes out of this. I got this crazy love for big installations.
And you mentioned challenges. What are the challenges of being in China? There must be some language barriers and cultural barriers. And...
Yeah, there's of course the language barriers, but that's not so difficult because you always have one who can translate for you. One thing I learned, which is interesting, that's this culture. I don't know if it's a barrier, but if something is important, why do you make a appointment about that in 2 weeks from now? Now, if it's important, then let's meet now. Which made planning difficult, or not difficult, but just another way of planning. So I couldn't plan a trip from here ahead and say, can I meet you in 2 weeks? So when I came there, I would typically call people up the day before and say, can we meet tomorrow? And then we did that. Because, of course, it was important. Otherwise, I wouldn't meet them. Mm-hmm. Well, here, if it's an important thing, you better call people and let them know in good time that you want to see them. That was just one thing. And then when we had to make the contract for the space, the lease contract, whenever you change a comma or word or something, then everything we have agreed about have to be reviewed again. So it took a long time, very long time to do that. But then when it's renovation, my God, they just send enough people in. It took no time to renovate a building. I also saw some of the very huge buildings, modern buildings they built there, you know, you could nearly see from day to day that they were growing. You know, it's a very different way of doing things than we do.
What were the main things you took along with you from Beijing?
My relationships with artists, with Ai Weiwei, Liu Xiaodong, and a lot of other artists, Li Wei, Yu Hong. I made very good friends with a lot of great artists coming out of China. That's the gift I have with me.
We spoke about challenges before, and one would assume that it's easier in New York because it seems to be a culture that's more similar to ours, Western world, but it might not actually be so, right?
It's different. One thing which was probably easy for me when I came to China and I could come there and nobody had shown Louis Bourgeois or Andy Warhol or Rauschenberg or Doug Aitken or Shirin Nashat. I showed all these artists out there, and it was easy because there was no competition at that time. Where in New York, there's a lot of competition, you know. If you have to get people to come to you, you have to make some interesting stuff, and that's challenging, but that's also a lovely challenge. So it's very interesting to do exhibitions in New York, definitely.
Do you feel at home in that world?
I feel at home in making exhibitions.
In New York, I mean?
In New York. We have also done it in Venice, and we've done it in Denmark, and we have done it in China, yeah.
You mentioned museums with a love of space in Beijing, and we talked initially about Louisiana, which is very close to here. And we partner with SMK. What do you think makes a good museum? What's a good museum for you?
A good museum is a good collection. And both Luciana and SMK have a good collection. When it comes to modern contemporary art, post-war art, Luciana is probably the place in Denmark who have the strongest collection. When it comes to a more historical collection, SMK is very special, especially when we come to works by Matisse. They have an incredible collection of Matisse, but they also have a very strong collection of Danish art in SMK. And then, of course, Old Masters, they have a fantastic collection.
And what's your own relationship to SMK?
I helped them last year to acquire a masterpiece by Asger Jorn that I'm very happy about. It took 2 years, but you have to be patient. And that's one thing I learned. It's a very late painting, and Asger Jorn did. And it was Per Kirkeby's favorite painting of Jorn. I exhibited it many years ago and I had the challenge to get it to SMK now, which was wonderful.
And what makes good art, in your opinion? We talked about how you evaluate it financially, but that doesn't necessarily have to do with what is good and what is not good. What do you think constitutes or makes good art?
Good art have to challenge you, which we talked about. But when you look at a particular work within an artist's oeuvre, what makes this Jorn much, much better than the work he made half a year before, maybe same size, maybe same colors? I can't tell you. I would love to be able to. It's just something when you see it. For me, I always say it's in the guts. It's like, oh! And yeah, I can't say why this one is better than the other one. Why an artist is good, there's many things you can add to that, that they meant something in art history and so on. And Jorn definitely was an artist who meant a lot for his period. He was a very strong character in the Cobra movement, probably the strongest of them.
Do you feel that you've continued the same sort of love for art and artists that you had when you were a young student at the Copenhagen Business School and decided to venture into that world?
The problem with art is you get addicted and it gets worse and worse, so you get more and more happy. Oh, you can't live without it. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting following what's going on in the art world. You know, if you take 20th century, you had a lot of different periods where our artists were working in minimalism or pop art. And nowadays, it's very difficult to put artists into a field, I think. There's so much going on. Probably the exhibition which excited me most this year was a show curated by Jérôme Sens, a very good French curator at Museum Burda in Baden-Baden. I went to the opening and there was four artists. They were all good. There were four rooms, the individual rooms, but there was still a connection between them. And Jérôme Sens said something in the opening speech which have stuck with me ever since, and I've thought a lot about it. It was that all four artists, they didn't relate to art history in any way. There was not something relating to Duchamp or to Rauschenberg or Picasso or Old Masters or Impressionists. Nothing. They got all their inspiration from nature. That was the only inspiration they had. And then I said, that's interesting, and it's absolutely correct. And then I started to see that in many places. So I think we're going into a period now where maybe we had enough Duchamp. I love Duchamp. I love Rauschenberg. Rauschenberg was very inspired by Duchamp, one of my big heroes from the 20th century. and who I also had the pleasure to meet several times. But maybe there have been enough Duchamp, there have been enough where the art world look at itself. And right now, what do we need? We need to take care of our dear earth. And I see a lot of artists actually working in that field. And I think we will see a lot of exhibitions going forward dealing with that.
Is that important to you, sustainability?
Oh, yeah, of course. Mm.
How does that shine through in your work?
You know, when SAS introduced Pandion, that's above Diamond Card. You don't know how much you have to earn to get it. But when I got that many years ago, I was like, wow, because it gives you a lot of privileges, which are very wonderful to have. Then came COVID, and the sky we see out here, if you go out and look now, because we're not so far away from the airport, there are stripes always somewhere. During COVID, it was a blue sky. There were no stripes on the sky. And we have all learned that one of the worst things you can do in this world is flying. So I said to myself, I have to get rid of Pandion. It's not a nice thing to have. You shouldn't be happy to have a Pandion card. And I don't have a Pandion card anymore. But I have a gold for life because I had Pandion for so many years. I still have a few privileges, but I really try to fly less. And then we are also thinking more and more when we make exhibitions. And I think that's a big problem in the art world, that when we do exhibitions, we fly artworks from one end of the world to the other end to make an exhibition for a short period. So one thing is to make the exhibitions much longer. That's one thing you can do, and you can think about how you transport it. And if you can make the works closer to it. And it's not only me looking into that. I know everyone in the art world are looking into that.
You've been a gallerist for many years now. What makes a good gallerist? And what would you tell yourself, or what kind of good advice would you give yourself as a young man that you have learned throughout the years that you didn't know when you started out?
I still think that learning by doing is the best thing and best advice to give. I think there's one thing that I was asked in Moscow or many places at an art fair to talk to a group of young people who actually had this idea they wanted to be gallerists. I said that patience is the most important thing as an art dealer. If you don't have patience, find something else to do. So I think that's really one thing I would tell people.
Mm-hmm. And my final question for you, since we are in your home, in your private house, in Humlebæk. You have a lot of art on the walls. Which pieces do you value the most and why?
One I have in the bathroom.
Okay.
Which is by a dear old friend called Ernst Beiler, who made one of the best museums in the world, which is in Basel. And he started out as a gallerist in just after the Second World War and created, besides being a gallerist, an incredible collection. And he died quite some years ago. I was at a benefit auction some years ago at the museum, and they brought in a work by Ernst Beiler. It looks a little like a Gerhard Richter, it's a work on paper. And I said, I have to have that because I really admire that man. And I get happy every time I see it. And you're not going to see a work from me at any time because I can't paint, I can't draw.
And may I ask you why the bathroom?
It just fits there.
It just fits there. All right. Thank you so much for being part of Danish Originals, Jens. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the work you do and the work they do at SMK. It's one of my favorite museums.
Thank you. For today's episode, Jens Faurskov chose Henri Matisse, Portrait of Madame Matisse, Den Grønne Stribe, or Portrait of Madame Matisse, The Green Line, from 1905, from the collection of the National Gallery of Denmark. You've been listening to Danish Originals, a podcast series created in partnership with the American Friends of the National Gallery of Denmark and the National Gallery of Denmark. This series is sponsored by Scandesign Foundation and Studio Haslund. I'm your host, Tina Jung Christensen. This podcast is directed by Christian D. Brun and produced by Theresa Lai and May 11 Projects. Original music by Joachim Svar, executive produced by Christian D. Brun and Tina Jung Christensen. Please subscribe to Danish Originals wherever you get your podcast. Share it with others, leave a review, find us on danishoriginals.com and follow us on AFSMK's Instagram, Facebook and LinkedIn. Last but not least, we invite you to donate to the American Friends of Statens Museum for Kunst and become a patron. We will see you next week.